In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, May 7th, 2010, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And hour number two of the Friday show is always the Federal News Countdown. And this week is no exception. Happy to welcome to my studio this week Christina Morrison, Public Sector Marketing Manager for Hewlett-Packard, and Mark Rimondi, Director of Communications for the Harris Corporation. Folks, great to have you in the studio this week.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to do it. You got here with Nitmar. This is your first time here, isn't it, Mark?
It is. It's my first time on air with you, Francis, but not my first time at this great studio.
Okay, you were here when you were with DHS, right?
Yes, I was here a number of times with Homeland Security, and I've been here a number of times since with Harris Corporation.
Excellent. Great to have you both. News that we will be talking about a little bit later on the show, we're learning, as you heard from CNN, that there is an update to the situation in Times Square. They found somebody. It sounds to me like it's somebody's lunch, but I mean, given what's gone on there over the last week or week and a half, has to be checked out. And there's details about that posted now at federalnewsradio.com. But of course, the Federal News Countdown is what we do every week at this time. We've got all the six of the stories that Mark and Christina have chosen posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, so you can read them as we go along, and we will dig right into the countdown with
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week, according to Christina Morrison, is from Defense News, Defense Systems, rather. And the headline is Social Media and the Generational Divide. What scares Lieutenant Colonel Charlotte Herring, Chief of the Information Technology Division at the Army's Judge Advocate General Corps, most about young agency employees? The fact that they're on their personal Facebook accounts all the time. Christina, what did you see in this that you thought was significant?
You know, what I saw in this article, and I think it's timely as we're approaching June or approaching the graduation season, the article explores the need for social networking and the changes that the next generation of workers is going to require and the benefits that they're going to bring to the federal government. This next generation of workforce grew up with technology, with the internet in their home, with email. And they bring to the office and to the federal government a different kind of skill set, some new technology and some new interests and ways of communicating with each other, as well as, you know, the government being able to communicate with citizens.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first time I think that we've ever seen three generations working together. We still see the baby boomers out there working along with Gen X and Gen Y now coming in. Mm-hmm. And this article interests me because it shows how all three of these generations can learn from each other and embrace a new tool for communication.
Steve Ressler is the guru of GovLoop, created it, and information technology specialist at ICE for a long time, and put this community together that just, I mean, tons of people use. And I think it will be interesting to follow the development of the kind of GovLoop parallel mm-hmm. that GSA is putting together. Because Bev Godwin said about it last week, and we ran that highlight on this program, was that essentially they want something that's behind the government firewall that kind of has the stamp of approval of the federal government itself. But I think it says something at how seriously GSA and the administration overall is really getting into this game.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the government at a federal level is recognizing that social media is here to stay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, years ago, there were folks who sat back and looked at, you know, typewriters and typing as, oh, that's a fad. That's not going anywhere. And, mm-hmm. and a web page, why do I need that? I think we see at the federal level, as well as even at the corporate level, social media is a tool and it's a tactic and it's a new form of communicating and engaging with whether it's your customers or your citizens.
Mm-hmm. This is story number three, as chosen by Christina Morrison of HP from Defense Systems. The headline, Social Media and the Generational Divide. Mark, your story number three this week is a Federal News Radio story with the headline, House Rejects a Telework Bill. We talked about this on the program yesterday with Max Kakis, who did the report on this. It was a 268 to 147 vote, the House knocking down the Telework Improvements Act. But it turns out now that we've had a day to kind of step back, and we'll dig into this a little bit deeper later on in the show, too. But it turns out as we step back from this, this was more a procedural thing than the fact that the House of Representatives is really opposed to the government teleworking. Is what
it looks like there's you know, the Senate still has some action actions to take, but I think largely the defeat of this bill was a disappointment for a lot of the feds who could have benefited from it. I think it's certainly for others in the area who are painfully aware of our terrible traffic congestion here. You know, it's a morale issue. You could argue it's an environmental and energy issue, productivity. There's just a host of reasons why telework is a good idea. It's technologically feasible. It's used by a lot of different corporations, and I think the federal government would really benefit from it in situations like snowstorms mm-hmm. or inaugurations or other incidents that shut down easy access to the city.
We apparently had a fairly high percentage of people teleworking during the now that it escapes me, that when all the financial leaders from countries around the world were in Washington a week and a half or
so
ago.
Right, the nuclear summit.
That's what it was.
Right.
That's what it was. And Director Barry said, you can telework if you're approved to do so. Go for it. Stay home. And we had virtually no traffic issues, as were expected, because of so many, you know, 80 million motorcades all around town and a lot of more security people than we're used to having.
Right. I think that's a good example, a great example, actually, because the traffic problems that were envisioned didn't really materialize because of intelligent things like communicating to the workforce and allowing telework. I also think if you look back to a week that we were shut down during the snowstorm,
yeah.
I mean, necessity being the mother of invention, you either work from home or the work didn't get done. And I think a lot of us just were as efficient as we could have been at the office by having the same connectivity at home.
Max's story says the telework bill was being considered under suspension of the rules, a procedure usually reserved for non-controversial resolutions and other matters on which there's broad bipartisan support. When a bill's being considered under suspension, it has to pass on either a voice vote or win two-thirds of the votes of all members. That's 290. And I noted with great joy yesterday that in the same series of votes, that this bill went down to defeat 268 to 147. The House approved a resolution. Of course, the resolution is non-binding, but they approved a resolution in support of mothers for Mother's Day. That went 417 to nothing. So everybody in the House agreed on that one. The headline on Mark Raimondi's story at number 3 on the countdown this week is House Rejects Telework Bill by Federal News Radio's Max Kakis. And we have links to all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're up to story number 2, and we'll count those down in just a few moments when In-Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Latest strategies for meeting the OMB directive for data center consolidation. Join leading experts from government and industry as they explore the best in consolidation and how to chart a practical roadmap to OMB compliance at the GTSI Technology Leadership Series, May 12th at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. Attend and receive a free copy of their new federal IT survey on virtualization. To register, visit gtsi.com/TLS. GTSI, one mission, yours.
What is health information technology? How does the use of health IT benefit healthcare users and public health in general? What is being done to increase the adoption of health IT? Listen next week as these questions and more will be explored with Dr. David Blumenthal, National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour. Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The World Bank Group recently made many of its statistical databases available to the public online. The site is data.worldbank.org and is a place for global crowdsourcing. The move has required the cooperation of several governments and groups reaching across the span of several cultures and languages. Some 2,000 indicators will become available that could be of help to researchers, journalists, non-governmental organizations, entrepreneurs, and students. Bank officials say the data is arranged in a variety of ways. Users can search by country name for information on health, education, environment, standard of living, cost of living, and other indicators. The website also comes with a variety of interfaces that allow a user to manipulate the data in a variety of ways. The site is part of the World Bank's broader access to information policy, set to be launched July 1st.
General Dynamics Information Technology, delivering the strength of technology to achieve mission success. General Dynamics IT. Visit GDIT.com to learn more.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorabeck. Here's what we're working on for this afternoon's Daily Debrief. You'd love to boost innovation, right? Maybe even get some entrepreneurs to help you solve your problems. Well, how well do those initiatives work? We're going to talk to a professor at the Harvard Business School who has some advice. And Federal News Radio's Mike Causey was at the Presidential Medal of Honors dinner last night. We'll talk to him about his night on the town. All that and much more this afternoon, 3 to 7 on the Daily Debrief with Chris Dorabeck and Amy Morris, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown. Mark Raimondi of Harris Corporation here and Christina Morrison of HP. And we are up to
number two.
The second most important story of the week for federal people, as chosen by Mark Raimondi of Harris, is the story from Agence France-Presse. And I'm sure I just butchered the name of that news organization, but it's a story that's headlined, Cybersecurity Summit Kicks Off with Calls to Action. This is actually a story I talked about with another one of your people earlier in the week. Dale Myros in studio with me on Tuesday to talk about cybersecurity and this conference. The Worldwide Cybersecurity Summit that took place in Dallas this week. And I'll mention the same thing to him, to you that I mentioned to him. As I read some of the remarks of people who talked about cybersecurity at this event, it seems to me that at least what's being said is the same kind of stuff about cyber that was being said 5 years ago. We have to be more vigilant. We have to, we get all that. But specifics were not as commonly covered as I would have thought at an event like this, now that we're 5 to 10 years into being aware of how serious the cybersecurity threat is. Any thoughts about that?
That's a really good point. I guess what you can say about cybersecurity, if you don't like a policy or if you don't like something about cybersecurity, wait a minute because it will change. You know, the cyber of 5 years ago is nowhere near what we have today, and I'll tell you that what cyber is going to look like in 5 years from now won't look like anything but what we're doing today. I think that the article that we're talking about here did a good job of really speaking to the fact that there is a need for more public-private partnerships. A lot of people are surprised to learn that 75% of the nation's critical infrastructure, that's banking, finance, electrical grids, is in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not government. These large government computers running the nation's cyber infrastructure. So it's a paramount concern that we have a much better system put in place. We need to go to more of a standards-based system. I think you could look back to when we first started introducing electricity into houses and factories. You know, the need for standardization was a little more visual there, smoking ruins. And so, unfortunately, it might take a cyber equivalent to really get people to pay attention, realize that we need more leadership, we need more standards, we need to, like Dale Myros, who you just mentioned, would say, think big, start small, scale fast.
Yeah. Cybersecurity is certainly a serious threat, but a lot of people have used it as a crutch or an excuse, too, as a reason why they shouldn't be more involved in teleworking and mobile computing.
Yeah, you know, I see it as a growing risk, and the awareness, the education needs to take place. I mean, this is a problem at the public sector as well as the private sector. It's impacting everyone, and as Mark and I were talking before the show started, it's a threat that has no borders, and it impacts everyone at an economic level, a privacy level. The list can just go on.
The thing that I have found when talking to people about this, no matter which direction you come at the problem from, the issue is there's this debate about whether there will be a point where we will feel like we've gotten a handle on the issue, like we can be. I framed it once as on the offensive instead of the defensive, but that implies that we're going out and committing cyber incursions against somebody else. That may or may not be fair. But just the idea that we are working to prevent attacks from ever happening in the first place, instead of always responding to attacks that are successful instead of not successful. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, I think with cybersecurity, it's something that you're always going to need to be assessing and monitoring and watching your network, and that it's always going to continue to evolve and the threats are always going to be there. It's just a never-ending process. And the key is just to stay ahead of the game and to be one step ahead of the threats that are hitting your network on a daily, hourly basis.
We also have to keep in mind that, you know, security is an important part of cyber, and it gets more attention than anything else, but it is only one part, and it's not even the main part. You know, like a mentor of mine says, you don't buy a car for the seatbelts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, seatbelts are a safety feature within the car, and, you know, it's an important aspect. But security is just one part of the cyber realm. You know, there's a lot of other. You need to have a trusted platform, something that gives you the ability to ensure reliability. Because let's face it, most corporations, most companies, even government agencies now, their livelihood is online.
Mm-hmm.
Being down or being without your cyber access is not an option.
A friend of mine pointed out, too, that you cited the number that you use, 75, 85. They're different numbers, but it's very high, the amount of the infrastructure that's held in our country in private hands. And that presents a unique challenge for us, because in other countries, if there is a cybersecurity problem, the leader of the country can just say, boom, we're going to close it down because we own it. And with that not being the case in the United States, you know, that there was a proposal that President Obama had that power, and there were some people who just went crazy. They just thought that, well, if the president can shut down the internet, that just can't be. And yet, there are a lot of places where that's the standard operating procedure.
You know, that is certainly a debate that has happened often, and I don't think we've heard the end of it. I think what you're pointing to, however, is really, to summarize it one word, is leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, there's a need for leadership at the executive branch. The administration's taken steps towards that. They have a strong, they put a new cyber coordinator position in. They have a strong chief information officer on the job now. But I think there also needs to be leadership on the Hill. Congress needs to step in and take a role. And unfortunately, what we tend to see is, you know, because of how full people's plates are, until an incident happens, you don't get the response to make big changes.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, crises aren't always the best time to make big policy changes.
Mark Raimondi's story number two on the Federal News Countdown this week is Cybersecurity Summit kicks off with calls to action and a focus on cybersecurity on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose, this week's Federal News Countdown, with Mark Raimondi and also Christina Morrison of Harris Corporation. We'll check out her story number two when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Radio. I'm Rahima Ellis. New York City police have evacuated a large area of Times Square as police investigate a suspicious cooler that was left on the sidewalk in front of the Marriott Marquis. NBC's Brian Shackman says no buildings have been evacuated, but police are being cautious.
People are being moved back, not getting explanations. You're just told to move. There's a lot of onlookers, so I don't know what's going on inside the buildings. I can just tell you on the streets, they're not being alarmist, but they're not letting anybody through.
It has been an up-and-down day on Wall Street. During trading today, the Dow has been in negative territory for most of the day, dipping as low as 200 points lower. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department and SEC have launched probes into yesterday's severe drop in stocks when the Dow fell nearly 1,000 points. Several European nations have agreed to help Greece out of its financial crisis. The agreement is expected to be finalized tonight. I'm Brahima Ellis, NBC News Radio.
The Home Depot has low prices on hanging baskets and container plants. There's a fresh idea for Mother's Day. Fresh blooming flowers that will last all season long, so you can fill Mom's heart with joy and her garden with color, all without emptying your pockets. Thanks to those vibrant hanging baskets and container plants that you picked up for such a great low price at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot.
Want to know how to really make Mom's Day? Hint, shop the JCPenney Mother's Day sale this Friday and Saturday. She'll love the style, you'll love the savings, like up to 40% off Worthington and 50% off new spring dresses, plus 40% off all jewelry from the One Kiss by Cindy Crawford collection. Add more savings, like $10 off when you spend $50 with JCPenney Instant Money. You love Mom, and Moms love style. So shop for Mom now at the JCPenney Mother's Day sale. Doors open 9 a.m. Saturday. New look, new day, who knew? JCPenney. Some exclusions apply. Offers end May 8th.
Checking your daily TSP ticker. The latest numbers from May 6, 2010. The G Fund is unchanged at $13.26. The F Fund gains 0.07 at $13.83. The C Fund drops 0.45 at $13.45. A slide of 0.66 for the S Fund at $17.79. And the I Fund down 0.56 at $16.78. Your L Funds lose. The 2040 slips 0.42 at $15.69. The 2030 down 0.36 at $15.53. The 2020 drops 0.29 at 15.39. The 2010 loses 0.10. It's also 15.39. And the L income falls 0.09 at $14.03. Check your rates anytime, every day on federalnewsradio.com. Dimitri Sotis, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The SATCOM report is brought to you by Hughes, the global leader in broadband satellite networks and services. Here is Tony Bardo from Hughes.
A federal agency's greatest asset is the knowledge and expertise of its employees. But with travel and training budgets limited throughout the government, how can agencies provide cost-effective educational opportunities to a nationwide workforce? Hughes brings the classroom to the student with distance learning via satellite broadband technology. Distance learning solutions from Hughes deliver training cost-effectively where and when it is needed. Incorporating fully interactive HD video and audio technology, Hughes Distance Learning Solutions can be multicast to classrooms and employees across the country, providing the online education and training needed to sustain a world-class workforce.
Visit today's complete SATCOM report on federalnewsradio.com. Visit Hughes on the web at government.hughes.com or call 800-498-4909.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down the walls and enabling face-to-face communication, regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at breakdownthewalls.com.
Staying connected on the road or in the field isn't just convenient. It's crucial to ensure remote worker productivity and continuity of operations. That's why your agency should choose Verizon Wireless. Our scalable telework solutions help work teams like yours stay connected and maintain secure access to mission-critical applications, all with America's largest and most reliable 3G network. Put your mission on the map. Call 1-800-561-6227 today to schedule a demonstration of our cost-effective voice and data solutions.
Scientist David Matotsky of Berlin's Free University can turn the steering wheel of his car with just eye movements. He developed software called iDriver, and he's driving it around Berlin just by looking in different directions. iDriver lets you drive the car up to 31 miles an hour. It remains unclear whether this will be commercialized. This is the bad idea of the week.
Stay up to date with technology. It's Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It was such a surreal experience to be getting ready for class and then a few hours later being diagnosed with cancer. It's just unbelievable. I was told I had 2.5 years to live.
When John Ivey was diagnosed with cancer, he couldn't afford the medicine he needed.
When it came down to money, it's very devastating. And here's a new drug that's potentially life-saving. And then all of a sudden to be told you can't afford it, you can't have it. I was dying, and I wanted to live.
John contacted Novartis about the medicine he needed.
They told us to just forget about the money portion of it. They basically eliminated that part of the equation and said, let's just get you well. If it wasn't for people like that, people like me wouldn't be here.
Developing new medicines, getting them to the patients who need them. Novartis. Think what's possible.
When President Obama was elected, he promised to modernize the federal government, bringing 21st century thinking to a 20th century bureaucracy. On May 20th, join AFSEA Bethesda for a breakfast discussing the WhiteHouse.gov initiatives. This event will highlight how these online innovations have fostered transparency, accountability, and efficiency across the federal government. That's May 20th at the Bethesda North Marriott. To register, visit bethesda-afsea.org/maybreakfast.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We are up to story number two on the Federal News Countdown this week, and Christina Morrison's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is headline, President Obama declares Tennessee a disaster area, from the Nashville Business Journal. And, I mean, we've seen the pictures of the flooding in Tennessee. We've heard about what's going on down there. There is a big federal presence there. And you were talking during the break that you were headed for Tennessee when this happened, and there are a lot of people who aren't normally in Tennessee who were there. What's the deal with that?
So I was on my way to Tennessee. I was on my way to the airport when I got the call from some other folks from HP who were down there saying, don't come due to the rain.
Mm-hmm.
But we and many other companies such as Harris, we were on our way to the Grand Ole Opry, to the Gaylord, for the annual DISA conference put on by AFSEA. So there were plenty of local folks from D.C. here, especially the AFSEA chapters, the international chapter down there hosting this event. And we're all impacted by the floods that started. They had to participate in the evacuations, et cetera. Luckily, all of our staff here, and I know the AFSEA staff, have made it home and are safe. But my heart goes out to the residents of Tennessee, and then the things that they've lost in their homes, the things that can't be replaced,
yeah.
You know, the baby photos and the personal artifacts that can't be replaced. But I was happy to see that President Obama had approved the governor's request for disaster relief, because, you know, once you get past the point where the water has now receded, and you start thinking about getting these citizens back up and on their feet and getting businesses back up and running, I think the SBA loans that will be coming out will be able to help and alleviate some of the economic impact hitting that region. But the other thing that I noticed in this article was the need for a continuity operations solution, not only at the federal level, but again, with some of these businesses, making sure that, again, the technology that's needed is in place so that when a natural disaster strikes your region, your business and the economics of that community can keep moving forward.
The big component here that people think of first, maybe not the most important federal component to this, but what people think of first is the FEMA response and what FEMA will be doing. FEMA already obviously on the case there, and Governor Bredesen and the governor of Tennessee has requested FEMA's presence, so they go in. But talk about, Mark, what the situation is in some cases, because I think people have the misconception that when something bad like this happens, I should expect FEMA any minute now. And that's not the way that the system is set up to work, is it?
It's important to remember that in a natural disaster, the state and locals have the lead. They can request federal assistance, and like they did here in Tennessee, and then Homeland Security comes in as to coordinate the federal response. It very well may be that a FEMA search and rescue person is the first person somebody in distress might see, but that doesn't mean they're the first people on the job. It's always going to be a state and local led with federal assistance. And you're absolutely right. It's a busy week for FEMA. It's a busy week for Homeland Security as a whole, with the Tennessee disaster, they're getting dragged into the Arizona immigration issue, the oil spill, where they're helping coordinate the federal response to that, and of course Times Square attempted bombing.
Yes, it's a busy week this week for DHS, but it's always a busy week for DHS, isn't it?
True,
I mean, there's
that.
Always something.
Yeah, they're hard working over there, but you know, they're doing great work. I think we should be proud of them, and I know we'll talk a little bit later about the Times Square bombing, but I think we have a lot of things to be happy about this week with our feds.
You mentioned, Christina, you mentioned COOP and the importance of that. That's getting more difficult at the state and local level than it is at the federal level, because those are the kinds of things that get chopped first when times are tight budget-wise. And a lot of states and localities have balanced budget amendments in place where they don't have a choice. They can't run a deficit. They can't spend if they don't have the money. And this is the first kind of thing that goes.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. When you hear of a disaster like this, I mean, like I said, one of the things that just pops into your mind is the economic impact it has on a region. We were referencing the Gaylord a moment ago. Just think, that's such a large hotel and convention center, and the amount of people now who are out of work and displaced at the same time. They need their businesses back up and running and open and quickly.
I think if you look at the pictures, I mean, it certainly isn't a Katrina event, but there are parts of Nashville that will be pretty much out of commission for months until they can be kind of brought back to life. And as we've seen in Louisiana and Mississippi, I think we forget about Mississippi a lot of times when we talk about Katrina. But when you think about the Gulf Coast, I mean, there are parts there that 5 years later are still struggling for a comeback.
Yeah, you know, when the water recedes, the work begins. And I think what you're going to see here is, you know, the coordination between the state and the locals and federal, what that does, it doesn't just help during the actual crisis. It doesn't just help bring resources to bear to help save lives. It also is instrumental in helping the recovery process, which is equally important. Once the lives are saved and the rescue efforts are over and recovery efforts are done with, you need to do the you need to do the rebuild. You need to ensure that all of the federal assets that are available are provided, and that all the federal agencies that can lend a hand are doing so. It's still a state and local lead, but the feds can play a big role. And this is going to be this disaster is incredible. I think it's record-setting flood. So they're going to have a lot of work to do. They'll get a lot of assistance from the federal government, and I think. We've proven to be a very charitable country, so hopefully we'll all do our part.
I know you're on the outside looking in now, Mark, but now that there have been a couple of these terrible incidents, do you have any thoughts about how the relationship building is going inside DHS with the state and local people? There was, if you look back at the whole Katrina dialogue, there was the situation where people believed, at least, that a lot of times these were the first contacts that were being made was on site in this disaster zone, and people were exchanging business cards for the very first time. That one of the stated goals of the agency since then has been to develop these relationships so that when you show up in Tennessee, you know these people already and you have an established rapport with them and you're ready to go to work right away. Are you getting a sense that progress is being made there from what you're seeing?
Well, you know, I am on the outside looking in, but I still try to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on in the department. I can tell you that, from all accounts, I think they're doing a fantastic job across the board this year. There's been a couple of political snipes here and there, but overall, I mean, when the rubber hits the road, they've been responsive. They've been providing relief and resources. Following Katrina back in 2005, which, by the way, was, a disaster almost without any comparison, there was a lot of efforts done. There was a lot of training up at the FEMA facility for people across Homeland Security. There was a lot of more coordination. FEMA has very strong regional contacts who are embedded. They do a lot of planning and testing and kind of war gaming out. And so, I think the absence of any significant negative reports shows that people are generally happy with how this crew is doing.
No news is good news.
Sometimes.
All right. Story number two from Christina Morrison of HP on the Federal News Countdown this week is from the Nashville Business Journal. The headline, President Obama declares Tennessee a disaster area. That story and all the stories that we're talking about on this week's Federal News Countdown linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And we are up to the number one most important federal news story of the week as chosen by our expert panel. And we'll cover story number one when we come back to Federal News Radio 1500 AM's Federal News Countdown.
Save money at HalfPriceDC.com with half-price gift certificates to the area's best restaurants, stores, spas, and more. This week, HalfPriceDC.com has half-price gift certificates to Ozio, Washington's premier martini and cigar lounge, where they practice the art of leisure. Studio 355 in North Bethesda, award-winning stylists combine cutting-edge style with relaxation, and Cultura, D.C.'s premier med spa, specializing in cosmetic dermatology, laser, and spa therapy, makes a great Mother's Day present. See all the offers at HalfPriceDC.com.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
Evangelist Franklin Graham prayed on a sidewalk outside the Pentagon yesterday after his invitation to a prayer service was withdrawn because of comments that some say insulted people of other religions. He prayed with a party of about a half dozen people for about 5 minutes at a Pentagon parking lot. Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell said he came, he prayed, he left, and it was uneventful. I'm J.J. Green.
There's a lot of talk about thinking outside the box. But what about thinking inside the box? Airink is a company that looks at every angle when solving problems. In fact, Airink recently helped convert regular cargo containers into sophisticated air traffic and communications control facilities for use abroad, combining the shipping box and actual equipment into one turnkey system. Imagine that. Log on to www.arinc.com to learn more.
Newsmakers talk to Jason Miller.
Vivek Kundra is the Federal Chief Information Officer.
What we're going to get from agencies is actually a set of data feeds that come out of their security management tools that will be fed into a centralized system called CyberScope, which will be operated by the Department of Homeland Security. And in this system, we'll be able to look at what's going on across the federal enterprise on as close to a real-time basis as possible.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
Thanks for listening to the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests in studio choosing the news stories that you're hearing this week are Christina Morrison, Public Sector Marketing Manager for Hewlett-Packard, and Mark Raimondi, the Director of Communications for Harris Corporation and a former Pentagon and a DOD expert. And we are up to, on the countdown,
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, according to Mark Raimondi, is headline, New York bomb suspect on the radar since 2004. This is J.J. Green's story from the Intel briefing on federalnewsradio.com. And one of the pieces of information that J.J. uncovered, source told him that Faisal Shahzad was the subject of questioning by a joint terrorism task force team in 2004. They were looking into a transaction involving a house in Connecticut, and yet somehow he raised no red flags. Did he have any help? Was the plot to bomb New York's Times Square an international scheme? And one of J.J.'s sources, Fred Burton at Stratfor, raised a point that was the first thing that I said in response to that is, who in the world can find a parking space in Times Square?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
That's just not accidental.
It's nearly impossible, right?
I mean, when was the last time you were in Times Square?
Is that a parking question?
What?
Or do you want me to talk about the attempted bombing?
The parking implications,
yeah. I can do both. I was detailed to Manhattan for a year back at Homeland Security, so I got pretty good at finding parking spots there. But in all seriousness, I think JJ's article did a really good job pointing out kind of the luckily the ineptness of the alleged terrorist whose name I'm not going to attempt to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, the tough thing about picking one article is there was so much written on that, and I think, you know, focusing to summarize it, if you just look at the timeline, if you focus on the timeline where it was 53 hours and 20 minutes from boom to bust, or fizzle to bust.
Yeah.
I think that's an example of a system that worked. It might not have worked flawlessly. It worked very well. I think the American people need to be proud of their FBI. I think they need to be proud of the Department of Homeland Security. And the NYPD was just crucial in making this a success story.
I was amazed at how fast they had a picture up. I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't a portrait. It wasn't like they cut a picture out of the guy's high school yearbook or something. But it was just unbelievable to me.
I believe, and I would have to confirm this, but I believe that photo came from the ICE database, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement database from the naturalization records. And I what I've heard is that picture was provided to the JTTF by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and it enabled them to take it to somebody and get a positive ID on regarding the buyer of the car.
So
it was a big break. You know, I think what this really shows is the federal agencies and the NYPD and others are working together. It's the way the system's supposed to work. It worked tremendously here. And I think there are lessons to learn. I'm not going to say that it was all perfect, but the talents and resources of the nation's law enforcement and intelligence community came together to get this crime solved in 53 hours and 20 minutes.
That's pretty amazing.
I think it's very amazing. I mean, it definitely shows how the NYPD and first responders this week, they deserve a round of applause. Mm-hmm. I mean, between what we just talked about in Tennessee and what's been going on in Times Square this week, just the seamless integration between these agencies at the federal, state, and even local level, those folks deserve a round of applause for their work this week.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people would be surprised to learn that again, I'll have to check this figure, but my understanding is the NYPD is the second largest provider of officers to the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. Now, those of you unfamiliar with the term, the JTTF, when you hear that, it's a Joint Terrorism Task Force. These are FBI-led task forces in more than 100 cities around the nation. There's more than 4,000 individuals assigned to these task forces, which are coordinated by the national one here in D.C. But NYPD is the largest provider of non-federal assets, and Homeland Security, particularly ICE, is the second largest federal contributor behind the FBI.
You heard at the top of the hour that CNN was reporting that there was a suspicious package found in front of the Marquis Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. We're learning now from CNN that Mayor Michael Bloomberg is acknowledging that terrorists are targeting New York, but an all clear has been declared after authorities investigated a suspicious package left in front of that hotel in Times Square and determined that it contained water bottles.
Water bottles.
So don't leave your water bottles laying around in Times Square. And with all due respect to the serious attack that we had last week, didn't I tell you guys before we went on the air, I bet you it's somebody's lunch.
Yep.
So
you predicted.
I called this one, and I'll take credit for it.
I thought it was someone's beer, but yeah.
Well, it is
never
Friday.
You never know in Times Square.
Yeah. That's right. It could be anything in Times Square. Mark Raimondi, story number one on the Federal News Countdown. New York bomb suspect on the radar since 2004, as reported by Federal News Radio national security correspondent J.J. Green. You can find that story and all of the stories that we're talking about on the Countdown this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And also on the Federal News Countdown page, just go to the Schedule tab on our website and scroll down to Federal News Countdown. Find them all right there. Back in a moment to wrap up our countdown with Christina Morrison's number one story of the week on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be back in a moment.
Hey, Natstown, make your dollar go further at Nationals Park. Get your riddle. Watch future Hall of Famer Pudge Rodriguez, All-Star Ryan Zimmerman, slugger Adam Dunn, and the Nats as they battle the Mets Wednesday and Thursday, May 19th and 20th. Don't miss the best happy hour in D.C. $5 Miller products at the Miller Lite Scoreboard Walk. Spend less, get more, go Nats. Visit Nationals.com or call 888-632-NATS. 888-632-NATS.
Across government, federal IT managers are contending with the OMB directive to consolidate data centers. Are you on the right path? Join leading experts from government and industry as they chart a practical roadmap to OMB compliance at the GTSI Technology Leadership Series, May 12th at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. Attend and receive a free copy of their new federal IT survey on virtualization. To register, visit gtsi.com/TLS. GTSI, one mission, yours.
The latest from the Federal Security Spotlight brought to you by Cisco.
Worried about the internet routing table? You should be. Here's Doug Montgomery of NIST, who's trying to fix a big cyber problem with a solution called RPKI.
An ISP network re-originated what looks like probably the whole routing table, but about 10% of that leaked out to the internet, maybe 30,000 some routes. And the RPKI is designed exactly to address that issue.
To hear the entire show, log on to federalnewsradio.com. Will the top-of-mind security issues of today be the issues facing government tomorrow? Get the latest from federal experts on FISMA reform, the cyber initiative, how government is combating botnets, spyware, and other cyber evils, and more. Listen to Federal Security Spotlight, sponsored by Cisco, airing Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. or on demand at federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Security Spotlight is brought to you by Cisco, the leader in federal IT security.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight for May is Susan G. Komen for The Cure. Nancy G. Brinker promised her dying sister, Susan G. Komen, she would do everything in her power to end breast cancer forever. In 1982, that promise became Susan G. Komen for The Cure, which is now the world's largest breast cancer organization. For more information about Komen for The Cure and the June 5th Global Race for The Cure, visit station events and partners at federalnewsradio.com.
Time to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's In-Depth with Francis Rose, and the number one story of the week, as chosen by Christina Morrison of Hewlett-Packard, is from the Federal Eye, the Washington Post blog about the federal government by Ed O'Keefe. The headline, Telework Bill Fails in the House, Senate Delays Action. We talked about this earlier, Mark, because your story number three was about this failure of the telework bill in the House yesterday. And what's really discouraging for people, not just people in the government, John Sarbanes of Maryland, one of the co-sponsors quoted in Max Kakis' story that was Mark's story number three, blaming it on some partisan bickering and that kind of thing. But people outside government are not happy about this either, because it is just another delay for something that people pretty much agree across the board is a good idea. One of the questions is how to pay for it, which is understandable. But as far as the merits of the issue itself, seems to be a home run.
You know, when you talk about how to pay for it, I mean, I saw this in the article Mark had chosen, $30 million over the course of the next 5 years. Sure, that's a lot of money to us as individuals, but when you think of the amount of money the federal government is spending, it really isn't in the larger scheme of things. And it was disappointing that the legislation didn't pass, but there are already 10% of the eligible federal workforce is already teleworking today. And we certainly saw with the Washington, D.C. snowstorm this past winter that it is effective. And, you know, it does help keep the business of government moving forward. You know, we were talking earlier about the need for a continuity of operation. This, again, telework is a great way to start implementing and testing. Is your continuity operation, your disaster plan, is it strong? And are you going to be able to respond in a time of crisis with a solution? I myself have been a teleworker for the last 8 years, and not only see great benefits in my productivity. I'm not out there sitting on 66 doing a commute every morning. I'm in front of my computer probably more often than not throughout the day, because I don't have the distractions that sometimes the office brings with, you know, your chatty neighbors coming by. And the advance in technology now makes teleworking possible when, you know, just a few short years ago it wasn't. I mean, every house now is equipped with broadband and the internet, and it is a tool that offers so much flexibility to people and their schedule. And at the end of the day, it does improve productivity and that work-life balance and flexibility.
I normally don't get very political on this show, but there's one passage in here that sounded to me, quite honestly, like it's just kind of poor negotiating on the part of some of the sponsors of the bill. And I've had Congressman Sarbanes on the show, and I respect what he does as a congressman. But this article by Ed O'Keefe says the Congressional Budget Office estimated the House measure would cost about $30 million, a price too high for most Republicans, who also don't like the bill requires agencies to hire a telework manager. Agencies should be able to decide on their own whether to hire a manager, a Republican aide said. Now, it seems to me that somebody on Congressman Sarbanes' side should have just said, all right, we'll let the agencies decide if they want to hire a telework manager. I can't imagine any agency that if they have the option to hire somebody to manage telework wouldn't do it. And it sounds to me like if that's one of the holdups that he's citing in this, that should have been a pretty easy concession because, I mean, 99.9% of the agencies would have wound up with their hired telework managers anyway. And we'd have a bill.
Absolutely. I mean, the relationship you have with your manager is key. And you need that kind of communication to keep yourself engaged in what's going on. I mean, I've been a teleworker for the last 8 years. My manager lives in New York City, and I've probably spent four times, I think, I've seen her in person.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked for her for the last 2 years. But it's through constant communication, constant phone calls, or we also in her office chat with instant messaging. I mean, the tools and the technology is there in place today to open the communication and to make telework a solution and a viable solution for the federal government.
That is story number one from Christina Morrison this week on the Federal News Countdown from the Federal Eye on the Washington Post website. Telework bill fails in the House. Senate delays action. And, of course, we've got coverage of that issue on federalnewsradio.com. All of the stories we count down on the program this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And my thanks to you, Mark Raimondi of Harris Corporation, for being on the show this week. Christina Morrison of HP, thanks to you as well. And my number one story of the week, I don't normally give my choices, but my number one federal news story of the week is actually a departure. Federal News Radio's Federal Drive co-host Jane Norris did her last show with us today. She's going to work for Deloitte in a week or so. And so I just want to wish Jane well and give her thanks. I spent 2 years as the producer of the Federal Drive before I did this show. And so wish Jane well and best wishes to Tom Temin as he tries to survive the next week or so solo until the big announcement about who will be replacing Jane. And you'll learn more about that next week on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. A programming note that next week, there will be no Federal News Countdown on Friday. I won't be here. I'll be on my son's fourth grade field trip. So no Federal News Countdown this week. Countdown returns in 2 weeks and a brand new in-depth program on Monday between 1 and 3 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.